it's time for Truth About Markets on Residence 104.4 here in London with Max and Stacy for the next 60 minutes. We're going to be talking about all kinds of fraud and scandal and political mayhem and the Lib Dems and the Obama and Wall Street and the city. Stacy?
You just like saying Lib Dems. I notice you always say their name.
Yeah, because when we started this show, the Lib Dems were just a joke, really, and has been. It's backbench gadflies buzzing around, always sucking up, 15-16% of the vote. They had Charles Kennedy, of course, keeping it real for the real people, And then suddenly they got this Nick Clegg guy who's in number 10 with Dave Cameron, and it's a remarkable political comeback. And then failure, of course, because like Dennis Kucinich in America, they talk big, but when it comes actually to doing what they said they were going to do, they didn't do it. Dennis Kucinich is a representative in America. He comes from Ohio. He was lobbying for the public option, health care. He got to the last man standing. And then Obama took him on the Air Force One. He came off of that plane suddenly totally corrupted and turned around and said, yeah, well, we love the fact that there's no public option. Similarly, the Lib Dems, they are in the minority. They can talk big, like, oh, the people are not being represented. And then they get into power. Then they raise top-up fees like they said they were not going to do. They don't represent the people in the street who are fighting against the banking terrorists. So how did the old uncut protests do last week anyway?
Oh, all those Shadow. Those mysterious hooded, black-clad young men came out and smashed up everything, and that became the news. It's funny how these guys appear suddenly out of nowhere at every single major event. They are never, ever arrested. They always appear mysteriously and disappear mysteriously. The police knew they were coming. Remember, there were many warnings ahead of time that they expected some troublemakers. They had information that troublemakers were coming. So, of course, every time there is a gathering in any of our so-called Western democracies, our shining lights, we're a great example for the likes of the Egyptians and Tunisians. But mysteriously, always in our countries, every single time, troublemakers appear to smash windows and scare the average person.
Right, the agent provocateurs, It was interesting during the Wisconsin protests, of course, there was that fake phone call, phony phone call. Somebody called Scott Walker, governor of Wisconsin, posing as David Koch, one of the Koch brothers, one of the big money guys behind the Tea Party and all the climate change denial. They themselves are in energy businesses and other businesses. It's a private company. You don't hear much about them, but they're multi-billionaires. And they got this Scott Walker on tape just talking to what he thought was David Koch, saying that, the phony phone caller suggested, well, should we put a few agent provocateurs in the crowd to get something going to, deflect attention away from what's being said here, to focus on these quote-unquote anarchists? And Walker was thinking about it for a second, and he's like, well, I don't think we need to do that right now. We've got what we need to crush the unions and to crush labor and to keep wages at all-time lows. Now, on this show, Stacy, we've been saying that for years, that the labor and the union attacks, the way that they position it, is that it's public versus private unions, which is a subdivision going nowhere. It's a ridiculous argument, but it gets the stupid people to argue against their neighbor. Whereas the real problem is what we found out this past week. What to tell the people about the number of folks who are willing to work for free now in America?
Well, we covered that in our story there in the next Kaiser report, is that there are millions, there's 14 million unemployed Americans, but the new trend is for them to work for free in order to, I guess, avoid having a gap in their employment record on their, you know, resume or their CV. But you mentioned this Scott Walker, and it was worse than just speaking to David Koch, that he actually, there was an email from the assistant attorney general of the state suggesting that they use provocateurs. So this is a guy from a position of authority with, you know, part of the government suggesting this happen. And, but, you know, there's an article in Politico.com about this story as well. Cops, firefighters turn on GOP in labor fight. So this is always this weird propaganda that's put out in the U.S. is that unions are always left wing. Now, most of the union members I've met in the United States are right wing. They're always usually Republican voters. I guess I've met mostly firefighters and cops and construction worker type guys.
Yeah, no, the union member, I know a few in the Teamsters in L.A. They're all totally conservative right wing.
Yeah, so, but there's a weird myth. The if you think of what the images you see from propaganda from Fox News, it's mostly women. You know, they always talk about the teachers because they know that's going to cause, I guess maybe some of those right-wing union members who are men to instinctively have a bias against those union members. But apparently the obvious and very aggressive attack on union rights and collective bargaining rights by Scott Walker, also by Kasich and other governors, newly elected governors, the cops and firefighters are turning on the GOP. And I do have a cousin who's a policeman in New York, and he's also Catholic, so very GOP, very Republican. His that whole side of the family is very, very Republican. And he just said he's not, he's definitely not voting for the Republicans next time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's let's break it down so people understand what's going on here a little bit more. People who work as a cop, a teacher, a fireman, they could just as easily be stockbrokers. Because being a stockbroker, it doesn't require any real skill other than you're greedy. You are not averse to stealing. You're larcenistically inclined, okay? Now, it doesn't take a lot of skill to be a stockbroker or work on Wall Street. You're committing massive fraud. You're comfortable with that. So a lot of people who go into being these jobs like teachers and firemen and cops, they go into these jobs because they want to do something that's productive. They want to be they want to be part of society. They want to be part of something. They want to contribute something with their time and their career. And they're willing to work for less than their stockbroker buddies. And the quid pro quo is that, okay, I'll work for 40% or 30% or 10% of what I would make or 5% of what I would make being a stockbroker. But, you know, when I retire, doing this back-breaking work as a cop, putting myself in front of bullets all day, running into burning building, dealing with drooling, stupid psycho kids, okay, when I retire, you know, give me some kind of retirement benefit. Okay, that's the quid pro quo. I'll do something productive. I'll make sure the wheels of society keep turning. You can go to Wall Street and play your Ponzi games and your racketeering and your lying and your cheating, okay? All I want is a little benefit when I retire. So, because the alternative is if you had stockbrokers as firemen, cops, and teachers, they would charge $100,000, $200,000, $500,000 a year to do that job. No stockbroker is going to be a teacher for less than $500,000 a year. Now, that obviously would bankrupt the state, bankrupt the society, bankrupt the community. So, there's a quid pro quo here. It's an organic, natural, economic give and take. So, if you get rid of these folks and the amount of money they make in their pensions, whether it's public or private, is laughable compared to the banking community. If you get rid of them, those people, you have two choices. Either you let the kids die from their own stupidity, you let the buildings burn, and you have all the criminals running around in the streets, or You borrow another 50, 60, 70, 100, 300, $900 billion to pay stockbrokers to do these jobs. So economically, my point is this. The attacking public unions and public workers economically makes no sense. You are arguing against an efficient, low-cost system in favor of an inefficient, high-cost system.
Well, but you see it. It's very much the elite versus the peasants. And you saw that with, I believe it was Governor Rick Snyder, so of Michigan. And he is slashing all sorts of benefits, trying to remove all the workers' rights. But he himself hired his chief of staff or his communications director, somebody in his own administration, and he's paying her $172,000 per year. Yeah. And when questioned on that, he said he needed to pay her more in order to lure her from the private sector.
Yeah. Well, they're aware of it. They're aware that the economics of this make no sense. And the people in the government who are supposed to sort through the economics and the incentives and to create some kind of balance, they'd have no idea what's going on. They're all economically illiterate. That's what makes them valuable as representatives in government. This is why you have in America people like Michelle Bachmann or Sarah Palin. Okay, I'm not picking on women here. It's just that these are women that have demonstrated a complete lack of any intelligence or a complete lack of education. They're numerically and financially and economically illiterate. They make statements that prove this over and over again, that they have no comprehension whatsoever about anything that you would need to equip yourself to be in public office. But that's their role. They're there to be sock puppets. They're there to be trolls for guys like David Koch.
But, you know, I think the biggest problem, as you've kind of touched on it, is that the peasants are always set against each other. And what happens is, I forget the exact figures, but in the last 25, 30 years, the increase in the average private sector wage, they saw their incomes go up by something like 600% in the past, you know, few decades. Compared to the public sector worker, which saw about 450%. So there's a gap there of about 150%. Now, most of that for the private sector, for the public sector worker, was deferred into benefits and guaranteed retirement benefits, whereas the private sector worker had that cash and it mostly went into property speculation and into the stock market, which then collapsed. Yeah. So, you know, on the one hand, some of them did make the choice to take that cash up front and speculate with it. But others don't really have, but a lot of them don't have the option. You know, there's no guaranteed benefit system for them. It all has to go into the stock market or some other gambling sort of speculation.
Well, you're right. The unions and the workers, whether it's public or private, by agreeing to take deferred compensation, that capital is then used by the banks for free. They get free use of that money. You know, the unions, when interest rates are near zero, as they are now, that means the banks have free use of the deferred compensation from these folks who are working at below market rates as a social contract. Because they want to do something that's useful with their lives and not just be a paper pushing, worthless banking, you know, leech. So yeah, you're right. They are paying taxes, of course. They're the private and the public sector workers who are making these salaries that are being attacked. Of course, that's all taxable income. And again, you can't have capitalism without some kind of capital, which is derived from taxation through GDP growth, et cetera, to create the savings pool, to create the basis of your capitalist system. So the folks who are arguing against these higher salaries and against the benefits and against the workers, they're not arguing in favor of a system that has anything to do with capitalism. They're arguing they're kleptocrats, they're dictators. They're just like the guys like Muammar Gaddafi or whatever. And, you know, whether it's Goldman Sachs or Gaddafi or Tony Blair, they all come across as these ideologue zealots who have charismatic, you know, they're as charismatic as Jim Jones from the Guyana suicide cult. And they're trying to get folks to commit suicide on their behalf by mesmerizing them, by hypnotizing them, by putting forth their sectarian conflicts that they've cooked up in their sick, diseased minds. And unfortunately, like Cameron and Clegg are buy into it, and Osborne, they don't stand up in the House of Commons and say we need to protect ourselves against ideologues and zealots like Goldman Sachs or Muammar Gaddafi. No, they just go down there with their anodyne, you know, boring speeches that go nowhere, that they express shock. Now Osborne saying, my God, some of these, the economy seems to be shockingly in bad shape. I wonder how that happened. And it's all one big pantomime. You know, why don't you get David Hasselhoff to go down there and be the deputy prime minister and do a pantomime in the House of Commons? And, you know, people would love that. It's the same stupid nonsense.
Well, you know what? Speaking of Libya, it appears that our guest, Issa Bloomi, was correct about his assessment of what was going on in Libya. And he kind of saw that it was really about helping Gaddafi, right? That the ambition of France in particular, but the U.S., was to basically turn Benghazi into a concentration camp. Mm-hmm. That nobody liked the Easterners anyway. They were, you know, all these fighters in Iraq and Afghanistan. And but it's also from there that a lot of immigrants head into Europe. Mm-hmm. The headlines in The Guardian today, Gaddafi regime starts talks with West to end conflict. Rebels offer ceasefire as doctor says 7 civilians have been killed in an airstrike. So the regime of Muammar Gaddafi has initiated a concerted effort to open lines of communication with Western governments in an attempt to bring the conflict in the country to an end. So, you know, Obama has said several times now that there is no intention for regime change.
That's right. It all comes back to camel farts, because remember, Blair went into the tent in Libya, in Tripoli, with Gaddafi. Gaddafi had arranged for all of his prize camels to fart in Tony Blair's face, and within that gaseous fart from the camels was mesmerizing encoded messages to a trigger, like the Manchurian candidate, instead of the Queen of Hearts, the Queen of Diamonds, which triggered the Manchurian candidate to commit an assassination. For Tony Blair, it's the scent of camel farts. Now, his handlers, same thing with Barack Obama. Whenever they need these guys to act in the interest of the dictators and the psychopaths like Muammar Gaddafi, they have a spray of camel fart scent. Like, you know, online, you can buy that scent. It's called, I think it's called, what's it called?
Fart?
No, it's called, I think.
Honey, you can't say that.
Well, it's a donkey. I don't know.
Okay, so you were talking about camel farts.
Yeah, and, you know, it triggers subconsciously acts of terrorism by Blair or Obama, Cameron, Osborne, Clegg. And you know, this is how they've been able to keep power, effectively. Gaddafi, with his oil, which is fantastic oil in the East there, he's really a very powerful man, much more powerful than Obama or Blair or Cameron. He's obviously the most powerful guy in the bunch. And it's all managed through the scent of camel farts. This is how they've been able to do it.
Well, I think you'll see who will emerge as the new leader will be Saif al-Islam. And apparently it's his senior aide, Mohammed Ismail, who is in London speaking to Western leaders. So I think he'll emerge as a leader. They'll have to get rid of Colonel Gaddafi, you know, just to make the Fox News audience happy, because they've, you know, riled up the masses that this is a bad guy. But I think they'll install this, that Saif al-Islam, or as I call him, Saif al-Davos.
Cat Stevens?
Saif al-Davos.
Yusuf?
Honey.
Huh?
What's going on?
Cat Stevens?
So I want to move on to a story about Citibank, the world's biggest bank, or I guess it's the second biggest bank.
Used to be.
After the Chinese bank now.
And it's on part by that Saudi billionaire.
Oh, yeah.
The sock puppet. What's his name?
Actually, BNP Paribas is bigger than Citibank now, too. So, Indonesia. Citibank debt collectors arrested in death of client over credit card. So, Citibank hired some debt collectors to meet with this Indonesian politician, well, a man who was the head of a local political party, and he was complaining about his credit card balance, which he said should only have been like $5,500. Citibank was saying it was $10,000. It suddenly jumped to $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
So this actually took place in Citibank headquarters, in their offices.
Mm-hmm.
He went down there to negotiate with them about this bill.
Yeah.
And he was met with three debt collectors.
Yeah.
And ended up dead of a brain hemorrhage. Now, the police found like blood and all sorts of brain matter and stuff like that in the room where he met with these debt collectors.
Yeah, his skull was smashed in, yeah, by the debt collectors from Citibank, yeah.
Citibank says, a Citibank official said, quote, "All agencies' employees representing us are obliged to obey the code, including the obligation to deal with clients without using threats," she said in an email. This is the second recent criminal case involving Citibank employees.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the Citibank is murdering people if their credit card balance gets too high. Well, I mean, you know, this is obviously the risk, isn't it? When you let a banker infestation multiply unchecked, it becomes like those superbugs. In the hospital in London, you know, they got the superbugs, the MSRP 7...
MRSA.
stroke 947B bug, which is, you know, it's resistant to antibiotics. And, you know, it's like gonorrhea multiplied times syphilis, multiplied times, you know, the Black Plague, and with a side order of gherkin. And you put that on your shveng-shveng, and you see what happens, you know. Then you got Citibank coming in there. They're like, oh, you know, we've got to extract some more rent from you because we're rent-seeking prostitutes. So I think we'll just kill you. And maybe the rest of the folks out there, the customers, will get the idea that give us all your money or we're going to kill you. Now, this is a banker infestation problem. And I think, you know, they're clearly very focused on what they want to do. They want to take all your money. Now, that they also talking about introducing $5 fees to take out money at the bank. So if you take $20 out of your ATM machine, they're going to charge you $5. That's a 25% VIG, 25% fee to take out $20. That's what they want to do. Now, this is a banker infestation problem. So UK Uncut and all the protest groups in the UK, they're trying to beat back this banker infestation problem. And let me point something out that I pointed out on Al Jazeera last week. In a normal capitalist system, you have companies and banks that succeed and those who fail. That's part of the Darwinian experiment known as free market capitalism. If the government won't allow any company or any bank to fail, it's incumbent upon the citizens to make this failure happen. So if the citizens make a bank fail, they're doing their job as good capitalists because you got to weed out the weak hands. We weed out the weaklings. Now, you got a few weaklings in the UK, and they should be weeded out. If the government can't weed them out, then the people, in the name of capitalism, they're not anti-capitalism. They're pro-capitalism. You know, they should rebrand themselves as ultra-capitalists or pro-capitalists. We want capitalism. We want Vodafone to properly go bankrupt. We want Barclays Bank to properly go bankrupt. That's what capitalism is all about. That's what they should be arguing for. And they should do what it takes to put Arcadia out of business or Vodafone out of business, because that's what capitalism is about. We want dynamic, thriving dynamism in our economy. We want opportunity. We want competition. We want banks that offer services at a reasonable price, because we want to be entrepreneurial and we want to grow. We don't want to live in a kleptocracy dominated by a few shysters trying to shove all kinds of matter up our shveng-shvengs. That's not what we voted for you all for. You know, so that's what UK Uncut should change their tactics a little bit in the verbiage. This would give guys like Jeremy Paxman paroxysms of confusion. What are you saying then? And he would just die from his own dribble. By the way, I was supposed to be on that show again this week, but I can't get over there. I can't get over there. That show, I can't get over there.
Well, you were recording a special documentary this week.
That's right. David Mitchell, he called me again. He said, come on, 10 o'clock live on Channel 4, Thursday night at 10 o'clock. Now, this is the third time they asked me to come over. But I'm doing my show. I'm doing my show. But I want to do that show. How's that show doing? I don't know. It's supposed to be doing pretty good.
The 10 o'clock live show, yeah. Well, you were making a really cool documentary this week with James Turk.
Gold Money Foundation. We got a great new film coming out. They talk about two times in French history, 1715 and 1789, when the government experimented with fiat money. And, of course, there was a colossal failure on both occasions. And what happens is, and you see right now, look at the price of oil, Stacey. Look at the price of oil. Look at the price of oil. Look at the price of oil.
Okay, here we go. This is going to be WTI price.
Or don't look at the price of oil.
Well, of course. I'm going to look at it, but it's WTI. It's WTI, which is 108. I think Brent crude is like 120.
That's right. And this is at a new monthly or new monthly high or average monthly high. Gasoline's at a new high.
The highest ever for March.
Yeah, highest ever for March. So, the old high, remember, 147 back in 2008. We're going through that. And here's the deal. The gas and the oil, which is, you know, the only time most people come in contact with the economy is through the price of gas because they're trying to get down to the, you know, to the store to buy some McVitie's crackers and a six-pack of Schlitz to get hammered before they, you know, beat.
Schlitz. I don't think people in Britain know of Schlitz.
They don't have Schlitz here in Britain?
No, I think, wasn't that like a really low-end brand out of Milwaukee?
Yeah, they got Schlitz was a good one. And then what else we used to drink back in the 1970s?
Bush beer. That was a pretty low-end.
Bush. They had Molson Ale. That's Canadian. That's pretty good. We had a Ballantine. Ballantine beer. That was kind of low-end. You know, kind of below the Budweiser, you know, made Budweiser the king of beers. You know, that was high, high-end stuff compared to a Schlitz or a malt liquor, which I never understood what malt liquor, what is it? It's beer with more alcohol or something? I don't
more
know.
More yeast?
Seems like that was popular in the ghetto, really. I guess it has more, you know, bang for the buck. That. So anyway, so where the hell was I on this diatribe?
You were talking about some McVitie's and Schlitz.
Oh, McVitie's and Schlitz. It makes a great little aperitif. No, before that, it was the bankers killing themselves. There was blood-splattered Citibank terrorists. There was a guy walking on the street. I remember.
You were talking about Channel 4.
What were you talking about?
You were talking about Channel 4.
Well, no, then you were talking about something.
Then we were talking about French Revolution. Then we were talking about that. And, but, you know, before that...
Oh, yeah, price of gas. Gas and oil. So go ahead.
Yeah,
so everyone say, here's the thing. You see, this is the word because it's narcissistically psychotic or economic narcissism. So you got the price of gas is going up, right? So people don't understand that the reason the price of gas is up is because the government, to bail out the banks and to fight all these stupid wars, keeps printing money. Okay, that's called inflation. And as a result, the price of gas and food is going up. So the people, the stupid people, not listeners to this show, of course, but everybody else, they start demanding that the government issue more stupid paper money. They start demanding more QE, more quantitative easing. Because, of course, quantitative easing is supposed to expire in June. And the market will start to crash again. Then the people will demand more quantitative easing. Which, of course, will mean that the price of oil keeps going higher. So now we're in that phase of this mania where they're going to just keep printing money and keep chasing oil and food prices higher with more cheap money, which makes it go higher and higher. So now we're in the final... We're in the final throes of a melt-up. We're in a Minsky moment of a melt-up, a crack-up, boom. Also, you could read about this over there at Eric Jansen's site, the itulip.com, I-T-U-L-I-P.com, which is very good about describing all this stuff. And so now we're at the crack-up boom stage. I think Eric Jansen has a probability of hyperinflation of less than 20%. I don't know what his recent reading on that is. You got Gonzalo Lira in Chile. He believes that the hyperinflation is baked into the cake, and it's a dead certainty, from if I remember what he was saying recently. You got myself. You know, I'm looking obviously toward the dollar collapsing, and so, but here's what the public. My point is that the public stupidly demands for more money printing, which is the worst possible thing. But this is what happens when you're in the throes of a mania in a Jim Jones-like suicide cult.
Well, but speaking of suicide cults, you know, we let these the likes of Citibank roam around the world and abuse third and second worlders, or, you know, non-Western nations, developing nations, whatever you want to call them. They're over in Indonesia murdering people over a $5,000 credit card bill. And by the way, those three Citibank employees, they face 5 years maximum in prison.
Suspended.
Because they're under a different code. They operate under a different code. But remember a few years ago, I think when we first started doing this Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM, that we covered in India, Citibank was found to be sending debt collection letters to Indians saying, we will use Russian methods to collect our debts.
Yeah.
So these are the sort of things that we see, you know, they test run it. They perfect these methods in developing countries, which have less, which are easier to get away with these sort of crimes. And then they bring them to the West. They bring them here, but they've been tested and honed and made very robust, these operating systems, before they're introduced into the West.
Yeah.
And you see that with those, the, ATM fees being charged. So you're saying it's a $5 flat fee. And of course, you see what happens is somebody who's only making $200 a week at Walmart.
Yeah.
They're going to be able to take out, what, $20, $30 at a time. And like you said, they're being taxed basically 20% to withdraw their cash. Somebody who's going to be able to take $500 out at a time, that's 1%.
Yep, that's right. Now, I want to go back in history a bit. You mentioned our earlier shows back in the 1980s on Residence. And, you know, like 5 or 6 years ago, we were talking about SHAC, Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty. I believe that's gone, and I believe that whole campaign is gone. And, of course, that group got involved in some violent activities, which we don't condone, and we're totally against it. But they also were involved in some nonviolent activities, which I think you got to keep in mind here. There was a company called Huntington Life Sciences, which I believe was a British company. Yeah, it was. And they were successful in dropping the stock price down to zero, to the point where that company had to move to the United States. It actually was chased completely out of Britain. And they were very sophisticated in that they issued a kind of an annual report where they discussed the risks to the stockholders of the company involved in animal testing. And they were communicating directly to the stockholders and the bondholders and the pension funds who owned these securities about the risks that animal testing had on the stock price. And by law, money managers, fiduciaries, and mutual funds must, by law, take any risk seriously to the point of writing about it and taking it on board and discounting that risk in terms of the ownership of that security, and through by pointing out the risk over and over again to the shareholders and the stockholders, they got the stock price went to zero. Now, that's what's missing from these campaigns today. You know, UK Uncut and the rest of them. They're kind of fishing in the right pond, but they're not using the right bait. Now, if you're going after Vodafone, you're going after Top Shops, you're going after Arcadia, you're going after Barclays, HSBC, You have to take on board the fact that the only thing that these people care about, the executives and the politicians, is the share of the stock price as it's listed on the exchange. That's their lifeblood. So any campaign, you must communicate to your campaigners what the current stock price is, and that you will be judging whether or not your campaign is successful or not by how much damage you can do to the stock price, with the goal being zero. And so keeping that in mind, you know, UK Uncut should look around and they should do an analysis and figure out, okay, here's the 10 companies that we think stink for various reasons. Which one of these 10 is the one we have the greatest probability of driving the stock price to zero? That's the question UK Uncut has to ask itself. Not which is doing the worst, not which is the one that most of our followers think is doing the worst. That's not strategic. You're just diluting your efforts. And as you see, ultimately, they go nowhere. Take a page out of Shaq's trade, playbook. Target the stock price. And pick a company that you've got a fair fight. It's got to be a smaller company. It's got to be a company that's much more tied to retail sales that would plummet if you interrupted those retail sales or boycotted those retail sales. And you've got to communicate directly to shareholders by saying that their owning this stock is stupid because the risk to them is enormous. And by law, money managers must begin to divest themselves from that stock. We saw it in the 80s. I think it was the 80s during the apartheid of South Africa. It wasn't until somebody figured out that by boycotting Barclays Bank and by forcing pension funds around the world to divest out of Barclays Bank, did that apartheid campaign actually come to fruition and apartheid in South Africa was ended? That was the key campaign, the key moment. You put a dollar amount to the risk of apartheid. You figured out what company was most exposed, and you kept beating on that drum over and over again, and apartheid came crumbling down. So those are two excellent lessons that I don't hear in this UK Uncut campaign. I hear them attacking companies. I hear them attacking Philip Green and going after HSBC, and they understand that there's a tax problem. They're not paying their taxes. Okay, all that's great. But there's got to be a signal to the market of what it is you're talking about. And that signal, from your point of view, is always summed up with one word, risk. They're always talking about growth. You see, if you notice, when somebody comes on TV and criticizes UK Uncut or any of these other groups, they always say, this could interrupt growth. This could interrupt jobs. This could interrupt GDP. They're 100% oriented toward that notion of growth. Growth, growth, jobs, and growth. And on that score, the mainstream media always gives them a pass and says, well, we can't be against growth. We can't be against jobs. And it always works. The only strategy to combat that is to take the 180-degree point of view on the other side of the fence and talk about risk. Risk, risk, risk. You must communicate to the shareholders, the stockholders, the stakeholders, the pension fund holders, and the mainstream media that these company stockholders are taking risk. And by taking this risk, they need to divest. They need to sell. They need to avoid the risk. By not avoiding this risk, they're violating their fiduciary responsibilities. They're violating the law. They're lawbreakers. Forget about the fact that they're stealing, that they're cooking the books, there's accounting fraud, because nobody cares about that. There's no moral hazard anymore. But there is fear of losing money. That is consistent. And throughout history, people hate losing money. If you keep hitting that button and saying, if you guys don't get out of this stock, you get out of your Tesco stock or whatever the big campaign is, you're going to lose money. That's your risk. You see, then now it's a fair fight. Now it's you've got two combatants. And look what happened to McDonald's stock when those folks went and they sued McDonald's because of misrepresentation, I believe it was, in terms of what they were suggesting were the health benefits of their food. They went to court. it got in terms of the risk to the stock plummeted down 80, 90%. As a result, McDonald's had to completely redo itself and reform itself. The stock got down to $12 a share, and the company was closing stores. They were closing stores in the UK and around the world. They were closing up shop because of those two people who very famously took on McDonald's. They went to court, and McDonald's was unable to prove that the claims that the food was dangerous in some way, and they just dragged on and on. So that's another example of a campaign. Now, those two who went after McDonald's, they did not follow it up by trying to get that stock price down to zero. This is the frustrating part, Stacey, is that McDonald's was on the doorstep of bankruptcy because the stock price had gotten down so low that the company was bleeding and hemorrhaging liabilities and cash, and they were on death's doorstep. And though that McDonald's, I don't think a lot of people understand this, they were within 2 months of going bankrupt and having to completely close shop. Had there been a follow-through on that campaign to stick the knife in and twist it, McDonald's wouldn't be no more today. We would have gotten rid of that nutrition terrorist already. It would be gone.
Actually, I saw McDonald's in the headlines on Bloomberg. The headline reads, "France halts shale drilling as McDonald's scourge Bové turns on fracking." So, you know, José Bové?
Yeah.
He's now turned on fracking because all these fracking licenses have been handed out to Total and other oil and natural gas companies in the Paris area to start fracking like they did in the U.S. without any public discussion. Again, no public discussion for anything they want. Lots of public discussion, of course, about public sector workers and their union and their, you know, their pensions.
Yeah.
Lots of public discussion on that. But no discussion on any sort of story like this where corporations are just handed free licenses to go destroy our environment or, you know, extract our wealth without any sort of public discussion.
Well, here's the other remarkable thing about it is that, let's say a campaign successfully put McDonald's out of business. What's amazing is that if you took that monopolist out of the equation, you'd have 5, 6, 7 new companies popping up to fill that vacuum with new offerings of restaurant chains that would have to learn the lessons of why McDonald's failed. They would offer better food, better working conditions, and the necessity for jobs would skyrocket. If you got rid of McDonald's, the job market would be booming with all kinds of new jobs. If you get rid of the monopolists, you get rid of the Vodafones, you get rid of the HSBCs, the Barclays, the Topshops, the Arcadia, you get rid of the monopolists, and to fill the vacuum are many, many new enterprises, new companies, new startups, new opportunities to make lots of money for many, many people. It's a jobs boom. They say, getting rid of McDonald's will kill jobs. That's false. Getting rid of McDonald's would increase jobs by a factor of 500%. And they'd be great jobs because you're at the ground floor of new businesses. You know, you're now making extraordinary gains because you're filling the vacuum shut that's created by the shutdown of this monopolist, predator, nutritional, environmental terrorist, McDonald's.
Well, let's talk about the other public discussions happening, because in the U.S. this week, technically the government might have to shut down if the Dems and the Republicans can't come up with agreement on, you know, the budget. And last year's budget was $3.5 trillion. And CNN did a poll to find out where Americans wanted it cut and what they thought the budget was. So Americans flunk budget IQ test. So they did this national poll, and they found that most Americans, 50% want government to cut spending on public television and radio. Okay? So 50% of them want it cut. But most of them thought that the U.S. government was spending 5% of its total budget on public radio and television. So they thought that the U.S. government, the federal government, is spending $175 billion. public radio and television. They're in fact spending $400 million. About $10 million of that, or less than $15 million, goes to NPR. The rest goes to various stations and studios and satellite and stuff like that. But so here they are, like, screeching about cutting the liberal stuff. Like, they have this assumption that it's all liberal, but in fact it's not. But anyway, they're so confused about where money goes, and yet filled with such passion about cutting that, and that this would solve all of our problems. The other confusion is, one in five thinks that foreign aid takes up 30% of the government spend.
Mm-hmm.
So they think, what is that? That's almost $1 trillion, they think, goes to foreign aid, when in fact $3.5 billion does.
Well, okay, so what is this story about, really? It's about how misinformed Americans are.
Yeah, how propagandized they are. You could tell exactly where they're getting this information. So their biggest misperceptions are about foreign aid and public television and radio.
Right, and but it extends throughout just quite every aspect of their lives. They're completely misinformed. I mean, this is the thing about it, is that's why it's almost impossible to live in America if you have any modicum of intelligence whatsoever. This is why I know I don't live in America. I mean, it's like living, it would be living with the in a nursery with giant babies walking around. It's almost impossible to live in America if you have an education above a second grade education. It's just impossible. There's nobody there to talk to. You're alone. You're absolutely alone in America. I mean, as good as a tourist, you can drop in, go to New York, walk around, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, you wouldn't want to live there. You wouldn't want your friends to live there. I wouldn't even want my dog or cat to live there. It's too disgusting.
Well, but the other important thing to note is that capitalism and democracy both only work if all sides have equal information and genuine truth about what the true state of the company is, or the true state of the party or the budget or whatever it is. There needs to be transparency for them to operate efficiently. And in the capitalist sector, we saw massive misallocation of capital because of lies, because of gross propaganda perpetrated by the banks, led by the Federal Reserve Bank, led by the U.S. Statistics Department. Now, the same thing here is there's a gross misallocation of passion, of concern, into things that don't have any sort of significance or genuine meaning to your life. The fact that people are spending, exhausting their political passion, thinking that $175 billion is being spent on a media outlet they don't like, when in fact it's only $10 million, the huge difference. But there, obviously, that passion, that political awareness and concern is being channeled in the wrong direction.
America has become the world's biggest snuff film, because, you know, as you point out, for there to be competition, you need some distribution of information in some way where all parties have at least similar, working on the same page, as it were.
Yeah.
But here, you've got one group, the kleptocracy, that's just beating the people violently of their wealth, of their well-being, of their civil rights, of their liberties, and they're just violently beating them up. It's hard to watch. You know, I don't even like to think of myself as American, because I would have to associate with a group that's being beaten to a pulp and bloodied to a pulp by thugs and fascists. So it's hard to associate with that group, and this is really, as I say, it's a snuff film. I mean, when you're talking about American news, it's like the Blair Witch Project, or it's a snuff film. The country is being murdered by a few people, the same people that tried to murder FDR back in the 30s, because they thought, you know, he wasn't going to help American kleptocrats, even though he set up 50 years of the biggest growth period ever in the history of America. So, I mean, those guys are now winning again. There's no leadership. Barack Obama is a Manchurian candidate who sniffs camel farts along with Tony Blair and Dave Cameron to get his marching orders. And there's no leadership. So it's hard to watch. Now, it's less than 5% of the world's population is the United States. They've got no interesting output culturally. It's not any big loss. Just don't worry about it. We can absorb the loss of the United States. It won't mean a thing. And within 2 months, it'll be totally forgotten. Nobody will even really talk about it anymore. Let's euthanize this thing. Drop it. Get rid of it. Who needs it? It's like a impacted stool. Just defecate it out of the body of the global political system and flush it. Who needs it?
You bring up this short-term memory thing there, and that's going back to this cops and firefighters now turning on the GOP. The GOP, the Republican candidates in America, these governors and the local legislators are gambling on the fact that in 2 years' time, or a year and a half's time, that most of these people will have forgotten. The firefighters and policemen will have forgotten that they've had their rights removed a year and a half ago. And it kind of brings me to this quote here in the article. Although Indiana Republican, although Indiana Republican Governor Mitch Daniels has asked the legislature to table the right to work bill, a couple dozen Democratic House members stayed out of the state to stall action on other wage-related legislation they deemed anti-union. I think there will be a price to pay. Workers will take this for a while, but eventually they will stand up and say no. Maybe that's what is happening now. That's pretty much the way Ohio labor leaders describe what happened in their state. Most police officers didn't believe a restrictive collective bargaining bill would affect them, even though Kasich had been captured in a YouTube video talking about it. So the Ohio Police Union President Jay McDonald said, we still voted, we threw our support behind them. When the legislation was introduced in February, not only did it include police officers, its chief sponsor was Republican State Senator Shannon Janes, who was endorsed by the police union. He said, quote, "She neglected to tell us it was her plan to dismantle collective bargaining. In just a few short months, we've had a dramatic transformation of the feelings of my membership." But you see that he's saying they threw their support behind her because they didn't think it was going to apply to them. They just thought it was going to apply to other workers. Mm-hmm. Now they're angry because it's applying to them.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? There's a reason why parts of the economy should work through cooperation, and some parts of the economy should work through competition. You know, the public domain should be constantly expanded, not constantly diminished. That's the mark of a successful government and a successful country. That's not America. America, you've got sectarian violence between factions that are being set up by ideologues and Jim Jones-like zealots. And now they're just waking up and smelling the camel farts. And it was it's too far gone. And there's no turning back.
I have to interrupt because we're almost out of time. And you were just re-quoted in Ireland on the broadsheet. .ie. Ireland's biggest problem is RTE, says Max Kaiser. Responding to this piece yesterday by David McDreamy, Maverick analyst Max Kaiser takes aim at Montrose on his website today. The biggest problem Ireland has is RTE, the state broadcaster. David McWilliams can appear in 100 theaters across the country and light up the stage with brilliant analysis and provocative insights into the financial mess Ireland finds itself. He can write books, host festivals, and appear on dozens of TV shows. And all that work gets overshadowed by an act of omission by RTE, who refuses to report on the financial rape of Ireland by crooks that should be in jail. And then they end, "Who the hell is Max Kaiser?" They want to know who you are.
Well, hey, bring me, invite me over to Ireland, and I'll make sure that I avoid that invitation.
Well, I think that's a good place to end here, and I'll post a link to this on maxkaiser.com.
I gotta put my clothes back on.
Okay.
All right, bye, y'all.